is closed. Should he open them? If he didn't, the whiz would think he was in pain or enduring some other form of suffering. But for now he just wanted to vanish. Certainly, somehow, he could stretch this hospital stay on through next week, finesse the press conference, all the while realizing it would be no solution whatsoever. Why would they, whoever they were, be so kind as to keep Planner's Bank away from his throat in return for nothing? Had he really become so weak and foolish as to think he could hide? So he opened his eyes. The Wiz was standing there, looking at him with a puzzled expression.
"Don't mind me, Wiz. I think it's the anesthetic. It really wipes you out. Makes you woozy."
He hoisted his body up an inch or so by pulling down on the handles. Wanted to show the Wiz he was still in control of himself. He sank back down on the pillow and involuntarily let out a groan, and sweat broke out on his forehead. He made himself smile, but it was a rueful smile.
"My knee feels like it's the size of a basketball, Wiz."
"I'm going to let you get back in the inert mode, Charlie. I just wanted to let you know about the bank and Inman arm holster."
"Thanks," said Charlie. "Keep me posted."
He attempted another smile.
"You know where I'll be."
Chapter 28 The Spark of Zeus. In his little attic room in Old Chambly, Conrad didn't need an alarm clock to wake up on time in the morning. The one window, the dormer, faced east and had no shade. By 5:30 a.m. the light was already pouring in, even on cloudy days. On sunny days, like this one, the sun shone through the dormer's tunnel as a beam, highlighting this or that promiscuous heap of old books, magazines, knick-knacks, and exhausted furniture on the floor. Conrad threw back the Madelassé counterpane, started to get up, yawned, drew in an unhappy lungful of the house's ineradicable sour smell of coal fires, kerosene heaters, and hurricane lamps, lost heart, and idly followed the path of the beam. It lit up an old, three-shelf-high maple bookcase. Into the shelves were stuffed old books, most without their dust jackets, and on top of it was laid out his uniform from Carter Home Care, a white polo shirt with the green Carter logo on the left breast pocket, and white ducks with a narrow green piping down the outseam of each leg. There were no closets up here on the third floor, and empty surfaces were hard to come by anywhere in the house. He sat on the edge of the bed in his boxer shorts and yawned some more. Well, this would be his fourth assignment working for Carter. He would be spending the day with an old couple named Gardner in a part of Atlanta called Cabbage Town. According to the Carter office, the old man had been paralyzed on the left side of his body by a stroke. The old woman had heart trouble and couldn't stay on her feet for much more than 30 minutes at a time. Many everyday chores, moving a chair, shopping for groceries, were beyond them. The job paid only $7 an hour. Carter charged the customer 12. But he could get by on it. One of the polo shirt's short sleeves was somehow drooping down over the edge of the top of the bookcase. It made no difference, of course, but it offended Conrad's sense of orderliness. He stood up and leaned forward and reached his arm out toward it. When he stopped and stared in astonishment. Behind the sleeve, on the top shelf of the bookcase, jammed in horizontally on top of a row of books, was a dark blue book, bereft of dust jacket, with faded letters stamped on the spine. The Stoics. His hand trembled violently. Such miracles never... There would be some... The book was jammed in so tightly that at first he couldn't budge it. So now he placed the heel of his left hand against the top edge of the bookcase and pulled the book with his right. It took every ounce of strength, but finally he got it out. Now both hands were trembling. He closed his eyes before actually opening it, for fear that it would turn out to be a dreadful joke. The novel he had originally wanted, The Stoic's Game. Or God knew what. Since the deputy had torn the cover off his book at Santa Rita, he had no idea of what the binding had looked like. He opened the book to the title page. And there it was. It was that selfsame type, which he would know as well as his own face. The Stoics, the complete extant writings of Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, C. Musonius Rufus, and Zeno. Dying to cry out with joy, he riffled through the pages. Epictetus, precisely where he was supposed to be. Conrad opened the Epictetus section at random and read. A disciple asked, "How is it possible for a man who has nothing, naked, without home or hearth, in squalor, without a city, without a slave, to live a tranquil life?" Epictetus said, "Lo, Zeus has sent you one who shall show indeed that it is possible. Look at me. I have no house or property. I sleep on the ground. I have only earth and sky and one poor cloak. Yet what do I lack? Has any of you seen me with a gloomy face? How do I act towards those of whom you stand in fear and awe? Do they not give way before me as if I were king and master?" Conrad held the book with both hands, and he felt as if a current were flowing straight up his arms and diffusing throughout his body. "Lo, Zeus has sent you one who shall show indeed that it is possible." He began laughing, but forced himself to stop, for fear of sounding like a lunatic to his new landlords somewhere down below. The book, the text, lit by a sunbeam here in the attic of the Hello Again. Was there ever a clearer sign that all this, the earthquake at Santa Rita, Mai's army, Lumlock, the trip across the continent to this little place he had never heard of, Chambly, all this was Zeus's design? For what reason? To send forth a messenger who shall show indeed that it is possible. But what is possible? To serve Zeus? To speak for Zeus? He had suffered terrible pains, terrible losses. But what were they? Zeus's trials, Zeus's training for the tasks ahead. By the time he came downstairs to the kitchen, Conrad had on his Carter Home Care uniform, including a pair of white leatherette shoes. He carried the Stoics in his hand. Brother, wearing a long nightshirt and an old seersucker bathrobe over his immense bulk, was at the stove cooking up a skillet full of fried apples. "Good morning, brother." Couldn't hear him, the frying apples. "Good morning, brother." "Oh, Connie. Didn't even know you was there." "I'm going to work, brother, but I wanted to show you this book. I found it up in my room. I'd like to buy it." Brother put the skillet down and picked up the book and looked at the spine. "The Stoics." Then he looked at Conrad. "That's some of you Zeusians, ain't it, Connie?" Conrad smiled in a bashful fashion and said, "That's pretty much what it is." "Well, I tell you what," said Brother. "I'll make a deal with you. You can have the book if you clean out the cellar for me when you get back from work." Given the chaos of the upper floors, Conrad hated to think about the condition of the cellar. On the other hand, no price was too high. Charlie had lost track of what time it was. He was lying flat out on his back with his eyes closed, watching eyelid movies and sinking into daydreams in which things, innocuous things, were happening in bizarre locations. A Coast Guard office on Sea Island. An empty water cooler. A young man lifting up the cooler's enormous bottle, tinted aqua. And yet he knew he really wasn't asleep. His knee felt gigantic and kept throbbing and throbbing.
And then, what was it? A shadow falling across an eyelid movie? A sound? He was aware that someone was standing by the bed. He opened his eyes. A black man, a light-skinned black man, dressed to kill. A striped, high-collared shirt that made his mauve necktie pop out in a certain way. A chalk-striped, double-breasted suit, leaning against the stainless steel railings of the bed so that his face seemed to be up above him like an October moon. Who the hell was he? What was he doing here? This black man, standing here, looking down at me in my bed. Then it dawned on him. Farik Fanon's lawyer, Roger White. "Mr. Croker," said the head above him. "How are we doing?" "How are we doing?" Charlie resented everything about the question. The tone. The tone you use to talk to hopeless, aging invalids. The idiocy. The idiocy of asking someone stroked out on a hospital bed how he's doing. And above all, the presumption. The presumption that the two of them were intertwined in any way whatsoever. What he resented most of all was the fact that it was true, that he had let it become true, that he was intertwined with this man, in a perfidious union. All the same, how dare he come walking into his hospital room like this? Where was the nurse? Always out of the room when he needed her. Wait a minute. She doesn't come on until 4. How'd you know where I was? He meant it to be intimidating, but it had a furtive, croaking quality to it. He reached for the handles and pulled himself up a few inches, so that the black man would be aware of his strength. If he were well, if he were himself, if he'd give him a good tongue-lashing. Roger White smiled. Your office was very protective. Wouldn't even hint where you were. Luckily, an acquaintance of yours happened to run into somebody in our firm and mention you'd undergone surgery. What acquaintance? Asked Charlie from deep down in his throat. He'd gladly strangle whoever it was if only he didn't feel so tired and inert. I don't know, said Roger. He didn't say. He could tell Croker was not happy. But Wes Jordan was not happy that Charlie Croker had suddenly disappeared on him either. It was only because one Emery Knuckles, Croker's surgeon, had name-dropped to Zandy Scott the fact that he had sawed away on this eminent knee here, and because Zandy had passed this gossip along in a loud voice to a client named Howell Hendricks within Roger's earshot. But Roger had even gotten wind of where Croker had disappeared to. Croker was no longer the mighty king of the crackers. He looked weak enough for him, Roger, to berate for pulling a disappearing act, for checking into the hospital without saying a word. But Roger was not a Don Pickett. He was not aggressive by nature, and he was afraid it wouldn't come out right. So what he said was, "You had us worried, Mr. Croker. Suddenly you disappeared. We're organizing the press conference. We can't wait much longer. We've got the mayor lined up, but what we need is you. I don't know what the mayor is going to say, but I feel pretty sure he's going to call for calm, so this thing doesn't spin out of control. Having somebody as prominent as you are, somebody who's a member of the city's business establishment, having somebody like you at the press conference, somebody who happens to have been a great sports star for Georgia Tech in his own day, is going to make all the difference in the world." What was that in Croker's eyes? Fear? Pain? Anger? Charlie was horrified by this twist of fate. The son of a bitch had found him. He couldn't even hide behind his knee. But he could try. "I'm afraid I'm not much good for a while." He gestured toward his knee with his right hand and gave the black man a look of glum resignation. "You can't make it to a press conference next week?" Gloom. "I don't see how." Roger had the strange, not at all unpleasant feeling that he had this supposedly big, powerful white man cowering.
"Well, I don't see how we can continue to hold Planner's Bank at bay if you don't get up off the sidelines."
"Or how about this? If you can't come to the press conference, we'll videotape your statement on behalf of Farik. If we have to, we can do it right here."
"How does that sound?"
"We'll do it right here at your bed. Might even have a more dramatic effect. How about it?"
"Depends on how it's going," said Croker, mumbling.
"Mr. Croker," said Roger, "no matter how it's going, it's got to go. You understand? The mayor's going to be there, and we've assured him you'll be there. The two of you can do something very important for this city. I hope you realize that. One way or the other, you've got to be there, in person or on tape."
Croker, still flat on his back, looked up at him, blinking uncertainly. Roger looked down at him and felt like smiling, although he didn't. He had begun treating the big man, the big developer and Piedmont Driving Club man, like a disobedient child.
"Jesus God," thought Charlie, "this son of a bitch is jerking my chain. Well, I could change that in an instant, couldn't I? All I have to do is say, 'The deal's off.' One sentence is all it would take. I can salvage my honor and lose everything I have. Why kid myself? This is Atlanta, where your honor is the things you possess. Who's going to come visit a man who has salvaged his honor but lost his house on Blackland Road? Nobody." His mind kept spinning, and suddenly there was a flash of hope. "He just said something, this son of a bitch did. He said that I, or the mayor and I, might save the city from what? A race riot, maybe. Anyone objects, I can tell them that. It was a strategy to save the city. It just might go down. It just might. Is that what I tell Inman, too?" But then he lost heart. What would happen to the look on my face if I tried to tell that to Inman? Inman, who's thinking in terms of the animal. That was what he'd said. The animal who raped his daughter. On the other hand, he became acutely aware of what a wretched, sickly face he was presenting to this black man, who had been so insolent as to track him down in his hospital bed. On the other hand, the man had the magic ability to get Planner's Bank off his back. "I'm tired," he said. He realized he was saying it imploringly. "I'm going to try to get a little sleep."
"That's fine, Mr. Croker," said Roger. "But when the right time comes, you've got to wake up. You understand?"
Croker nodded a feeble yes.
"Well, just make sure you do," said Roger. "Or there's no restraining Planner's Bank. They'll do whatever they want."
Another feeble nod.
"We don't want you to turn forgetful the way you turned hard to find. You know what I'm saying?"
An even feebler nod, and eyes that begged and begged.
Cabbage Town, as it was universally known, struck Conrad as an entire village of dollhouses, an impression magnified by what he had found inside the gardeners. The neighborhood had been a mill village for the old Fulton bag and cotton plant until about a quarter of a century ago. The houses were little wooden bungalows, set on narrow lots fronting the narrowest streets in all of Atlanta. Many of them, like the gardeners, had no more than four rooms. Most had front porches, and quite a few had gingerbread ornamentation such as was in vogue in the 1890s. Nobody seemed to know for sure where the name came from. It caught on about 1910, and it was true that about that time gangs of young toughs from South Atlanta, white boys, would walk along the railroad tracks and have rock fights with the neighborhood's young toughs,
whom they called Cabbage Heads. In any event, Cabbage Town it was, a dollhouse village, and the gardener's dollhouse was a dollhouse squared. The gardeners were in their late 70s. A therapist from Carter Home Care came once a week, and a nurse's helper, Conrad, would come for half a day, 4 hours, twice a week. As far as the nurse's helper was concerned, his main task was to do everyday things for the old couple that they couldn't do themselves. Mrs. Gardner answered the doorbell. She was a slender, erect woman, with her white hair pulled back into a bun. She was wearing a summer dress of chiffon with large roses printed on it in swirls so subtle that at first the pattern seemed to be abstract. She wore a lovely fragrance. Conrad found her entire presence startling, although at first he had no idea why. This day and age, to come across a woman, or anyone, who had good posture, who had left their hair white, who wore it pulled back into a bun with hairpins, and who wore a dressy dress and perfume in the middle of the day, was enough to make any American 23-year-old blink in astonishment. The only weak points in an otherwise impeccable appearance were her ankles, which were swollen.
"You must be Mr. DiCiase," she said, extending her hand. "I'm Louise Gardner."
At first Conrad had taken this to be a speech defect. In fact, as he soon deduced, it was merely an affectation, and a minor one at that. Any time a word began with C or a G before a broad A, she inserted a Y after the consonant. Soon she was telling him about the garden out back and the car they no longer possessed. She had such a lovely, soft, southern voice, the sort of voice he always thought he was going to hear in Atlanta, that Conrad felt like applauding and cheering her on with that or any other affectation she might care to indulge in.
"Come meet Mr. Gardner, Mr. DiCiase."
"Thank you," said Conrad, following her. "But please just call me Connie." The house had an awkward layout. It looked as if someone had been handed a rectangle on a sheet of paper, and had drawn one line up and down in the middle of the rectangle, and another line from side to side, making four rooms. To get to any room in the house, except the one where you entered, you had to go through another one. But Conrad didn't notice that at first because of the extraordinary decoration of the walls. On almost every wall surface of the house were dolls and porcelain figures. There were hundreds of them, possibly thousands. There were wooden knick-knack shelves attached to the walls and filled with dolls, old ones, new ones, astronaut dolls, African dolls, Filipino dolls, Polynesian dolls. There were dolls resting on little knick-knack shelves that went around each doorframe and every window, all chosen for the matching or harmonious colors of their clothes, dolls of old people as well as children, dolls of famous people such as Mark Twain, Genghis Khan, and Albert Einstein. Still other knick-knack shelves were devoted to the porcelain figurines. In every room up near the ceiling, which was no more than 8 feet high, was a white shelf upon which were white figurines arranged so densely that at first you thought you were looking at some sort of frieze in high relief. The most beautifully colored ones, and some were extravagant examples of the porcelain maker's art, were arranged on wooden knick-knack shelves, like the dolls. The arrangements were precise. The gradations in size were pleasing. Nothing was out of place. Despite the vast number of objects, you were immediately struck by the unity and good taste of this exhibition of a lifetime of collecting. Conrad had no idea what the dolls might be worth, but he had only to look at the exquisite workmanship of some of the porcelain figures to know they must be valuable. Despite its dreadful layout, the little house's interior seemed like something lavish beyond all normal reckoning. Mr. Gardner was in the bedroom, which was one of the two rooms in back, the other being the kitchen. He was sitting in an easy chair at the foot of the bed, an old-fashioned four-poster canopy bed with an arched ladder frame covered in a mauve, purple, and yellow ribbon cloth.
"Lewis," said Mrs. Gardner, "this is Mr. DiCiase. Mr. DiCiase is from Chiara Home Care."
"Please call me Connie," said Conrad. He smiled.
"Welcome," said Mr. Gardner, with a weary gesture of his right hand that seemed to say, "Let's not bother shaking hands." "So you're with Carter."
His speech was not so much slurred as it was slowed to an unnatural drawl. The left side of his lips barely moved when he spoke. He was a handsome man, or no doubt had been. He was tall and lean, but his leanness was not the leanness you would call trim, but the one you would call wasted away. He wore a plaid bathrobe over a polo shirt and a pair of black flannel pants. On his feet were a pair of leather bedroom slippers that had dried out and were cracking. There was a small table just to the right of the chair, upon which rested 7 or 8 plastic vials of prescription medicines, a small Kleenex dispenser, and a glass of water with a glass straw. The water had been sitting there in the glass for so long it had begun to form stale bubbles. Conrad was dying to sweep the medicine vials off the table, toss out the stale water, remove the bathrobe, and take Mr. Gardner for a walk in the sun. What he said instead was, "Mr. Gardner, Mrs. Gardner, I'm here to help you in any way I can. Is there something I can do right now?"
"What I really need are some groceries."
Her accent was so soft, sweet, and southern, this seemed like the most sublime of blandishments.
"But I haven't even had time to make out my list yet."
"You go ahead and make your list," said Conrad, "and in the meantime I'll vacuum the house for you."
"You will?"
"I'll be glad to." The floor and the rugs were filthy, so laden with dust and dust balls and hair balls, it was jarring, given the meticulous care with which the couple had arranged the dolls and figurines, and, for that matter, their furniture. Carting their old Electrolux vacuum cleaner around these four rooms was very likely more than Mrs. Gardner was capable of. Her husband, who was probably slightly older than she was, couldn't help out with anything, heavy or light, so far as Conrad could tell. Both were retired members of the Emory University faculty. He had taught English, with early 19th-century poets and essayists as his specialty. She had taught comparative literature, and could read French, Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, and German. Her forte was European literature between 1870 and 1914, which, she told Conrad, was from the Franco-Prussian War to World War I. They had no children. 7 years ago, with their income at its peak, they had bought a big house in Inman Park, with scarcely a thought as to how they would continue to pay off the mortgage once they retired. Somehow they would continue to make money. Something would turn up. They would keep the house some way. 2 years ago, their backs against the wall, they had sold the house in Inman Park and bought this little box in Cabbage Town, with the fond hope that they could now live off the profits of the sale, plus their modest pensions and social security. Every spare nickel they had ever had must have gone into the dolls and the figurines. They were dreamers. They were children. But very polite and good-hearted children. Children you instinctively wanted to protect. When Conrad brought the vacuum cleaner into the bedroom, he said to Mr. Gardner, "Is it all right if I vacuum in here now?"
"Yes, yes, go ahead," said Mr. Gardner,
drawling out of the right-hand corner of his mouth. He didn't even try to look at Conrad. He stared straight ahead, slumping back in the chair, seeming utterly dispirited. Somehow Conrad couldn't just leave it at that. He felt as if he just had to engage this feeble old gentleman in something. He ransacked his memory. Nothing. No, a fragment. Part of a poem. "Mr. Gardner, excuse me. I've had the beginning of a poem running through my head, and I just can't think of who wrote it or what the rest of it is. They gave it to us in school." He looked at the old man for encouragement in this line of intellectual inquiry, but he was staring straight ahead with his lips slightly parted in their skewed fashion. Having begun it, Conrad decided to blunder on. It starts off, "I strove with none, for none was worth my strife. Nature I loved, and next to nature, art." That's all I can remember. Conrad looked at Mr. Gardner again. He still didn't look his way, but finally he said, "I strove with none, for none was worth my strife. Nature I loved, and next to nature, art. I warmed both hands before the fire of life. It sinks, and I am ready to depart." Walter Savage Landor, 1853. He was 78 years old when he wrote that. Conrad was appalled. He had inadvertently brought up a poem about the last embers of life. He was speechless. "Not so, Mr. Gardner. Landor was a good poet, but not a great one. He was too polite, too proper, too staid, too content with the comfort of what he already had to take a chance on his very best. How old are you?" 23, said Conrad, forgetting that his age, according to his recently minted birth certificate and driver's license, was 24. 23, said the old man, still not looking at him. "That's a good age to be interested in literature. You have so much time. You have so much. It must seem to be spilling out of your pockets. You don't need to worry about what an incalculable luxury literature is. Entire civilizations are founded without any literature at all and without anybody missing it. It's only later on, when there's a big enough class of indolent drones to write the stuff and read the stuff, that you have literature. When I saw all those eager hands sticking up as I taught, I always wanted to tell them what I've just told you. But what right did I have to try to play the iconoclast, after making a living my whole life taking it seriously? Or at least with a straight face?" "I disagree with you, Mr. Gardner," said Conrad. "If anyone has a luxury, it's you. You know so much about literature." "Ah, how do you know how much I know?" But things had improved slightly, at least to the point where Mr. Gardner was looking at him. "Well, I recited two lines of a poem, and you knew not only who the poet was, you also recited the entire stanza, and told me what year the poem was published, and how old the poet was that year. I'd love to know that much." "You're not aiming very high, my friend. Besides, that's a very well-known poem." "I don't know, Mr. Gardner. I'd love to know what's famous and what isn't." "Literature's a sort of dessert." The old man's voice took on a shrill tone, and the left side of his lips began to quiver, and tears flowed from his left eye. "Life's about things you know even less about. Life's about cruelty and intimidation." Now he was crying openly. His face was terribly contorted. Conrad felt guilty.
Had he driven him over the edge by bringing up those morbid verses? Conrad stepped closer to the old man and said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Gardner, I didn't mean to say the wrong thing." The old man looked up at him and shook his head, as if to say it wasn't Conrad's fault, and had a real cry for himself, blubbering and boo-hooing. Mrs. Gardner, who was in the kitchen making out her grocery list, stuck her head in the door. Conrad opened his eyes wide and turned his palms up in the look that says, "I haven't a ghost of an idea why this happened." Mrs. Gardner nodded, as if to indicate she understood, and then went over to comfort her husband. About 10 minutes later, Conrad was in the kitchen with Mrs. Gardner, going over her grocery list.
"Really," said Conrad, "I have no idea what upset Mr. Gardner in there. We were talking about a poem."
"It happens a lot," she said. "It's the stroke. Emotions that ordinarily you can control. They come right to the surface."
Conrad said,
"Then all of a sudden he was telling me about cruelty and intimidation, and how that was what life was all about."
Mrs. Gardner said nothing at first, then looked toward the door that led into the bedroom and said,
I think he's talking about the state of things in general, in the world."
"Did he say anything more to you?"
"No."
"Well, I think he's just talking about the world in general. He gets very pessimistic sometimes."
That sweet, euphonious, southern quality had gone out of her voice. Conrad was at the grocery store for close to 40 minutes. He returned to the gardener's little cabbage townhouse with 2 prodigious white plastic bags full of groceries. Mrs. Gardner answered the doorbell. She seemed highly agitated.
"Connie," she said, "just set those bags down here and go back to the store and get me some sponges and dishwater detergent and Brillo."
"I got Brillo, Mrs. Gardner."
"I mean vacuum cleaner bags. Go get vacuum cleaner bags, too, won't you?"
Puzzled, he stared at her for a moment. Then he heard the loud voice of a man from the bedroom. At first he thought it must be Mr. Gardner with his emotions boiling over. But then he knew it couldn't be. There was no way Mr. Gardner could be that loud or pugnacious. Conrad put the grocery bags down and started walking through the living room and toward the bedroom.
"Connie, no,"
said Mrs. Gardner in a loud whisper. There was a tremendous crash and the sound of glass breaking. Conrad knew immediately that it was the porcelain figurines on the shelf up near the ceiling. The loud voice said,
"I've had enough excuses!"
Mr. Gardner said something, but it was impossible to make it out, because he was crying. Conrad entered the bedroom. There was Mr. Gardner in his easy chair, blubbering and boo-hooing down the right side of his face, and as still as a stone on the left side. All over the floor, near the old man, were shards of white porcelain, an astonishing amount, many of them jagged with a knife-like, even needle-like sharpness. Sitting on the bed, insouciantly, with one leg and one shoe cocked up on the counterpane, was a beefy, red-faced man who was now staring at Conrad in a challenging way. He had a small black beard and mustache and long, oily black hair that he combed straight back and then let fall in a wild tangle down the back of his neck. He was probably in his mid-40s. He had a big chest, but also an abdomen the size of a watermelon that protruded so far from beneath his sternum you couldn't see the waist of his blue jeans when he sat down. Apparently proud of his big arms, he wore a tight white T-shirt with sleeves short enough to reveal a crude black tattoo of a coiled rattlesnake with the letters BTK beneath it. A truly botched jailhouse job it was, Conrad could see at once, with colloidal scars all over the place. BTK stood for Born to Kill.
Across his lap he had the sort of stout cane you see at cattle auctions, thick, unvarnished canes used for prodding the beasts into or out of pens. Conrad looked up at the ceiling. On the cornice shelf, an entire battalion of the figurines was missing, and were now nothing more than glassy fragments on the floor. It wasn't hard to figure out how they got there. The man glowered at Conrad and looked him up and down and turned to Mrs. Gardner, who had come in the room behind Conrad, and said,
"Who's he?"
In a tremulous voice, Mrs. Gardner said,
"Connie's from the Chiara Home Care. He helps out."
The man looked back toward Conrad, measured him once more with his eyes, and said,
"Helps out, huh?"
as if weighing this explanation for rational content, if any.
"Well, I tell you what, Connie, we're kind of busy now. Maybe you'd like to help out somewhere else."
"Yes, Connie," said Mrs. Gardner, now highly nervous. "I forgot to ask you to get a couple of things, some, filters for the vacuum cleaner, and, some Brillo pads, I mean detergent for the dishwasher. If you could just go back—"
Conrad took a deep breath and prayed to Zeus for strength, even though he never thought of what he was now doing as prayer. He crossed his arms over his chest to give the man a good look at his big forearms. He looked at Mrs. Gardner, and then at Mr. Gardner, and then he said, "I heard a crash. How'd all these figurines get broken?" The old couple turned toward each other with looks of terrifying premonition. The man on the bed now held the cattle cane in his lap in his right hand, and tapped the shaft up and down on the palm of his left hand. He smiled and spoke with a menacing sweetness.
"Didn't you hear, Connie?
We're a little busy here at the moment. Do what the lady says. Go get some filters and some Brillo pads. Be a good fellow."
He motioned toward the front door with his chin and looked at Conrad down his nose. Conrad had no plan, but he could hear 5-0 saying,
"Use the mouth."
"BTK, huh?" said Conrad. "So you bend down? Congratulations."
The man began to wrap the shaft of the cattle cane into his palm more forcefully. He stared at Conrad and cocked his head to one side and said,
"Look, pal, that downtime tattoo artist of yours either blind or on crack. You know what I'm saying?" "Okay, buddy. Why are you trying to run a game on these good people?" said Conrad, gesturing toward the old couple. "Can't you find nobody better to dog? Before you be sweating the gardeners? Why you want to be getting over on them?"
With that, the man on the bed pointed the cattle cane toward Conrad and said,
"I don't know what—"
Conrad's hands flew toward the cane. He grabbed the shaft and jerked it back with such force that the man lost his grip. Conrad now held it in front of himself as if he were a dojo stick warrior.
"Now what you gonna do? This game is over lest you wants to get your cap peeled. You understand what I'm saying? Get your cap peeled."
The man on the bed straightened up a bit and slid his leg partly off the bed. But he didn't dare indicate that he might be getting in a position to fight. And in that moment, Conrad knew he had him. It was as if the spark of Zeus filled the room.
"Look, you know what NB stands for?"
Conrad was only barely aware that his teeth were showing and he was seething.
"You know what NB stands for?"
The man said nothing, but by the look in his eyes it was obvious that he knew NB meant Nordic Bund.
"We got a motto," said Conrad. "All for one, and all on one. You understand? If you ever so much as cast a shadow on this house again, we'll cut your peanuts off with a gelding knife and stuff 'em down your throat. My shut collar from last time down lives 2 blocks from here. He'd just as soon peel your cap as look at you. Fact, he'd be liking it better peeling your cap. Now get the hell out of here. You know where the door is."
Slowly, warily, the man edged off the bed and stood up. Conrad kept the cattle cane in front of him, but no longer stood seething. Now he had a look of cold confidence. The man headed to the front door with Conrad right behind him. The scraggly mane of black hair at the back of his head bounced on the hump of his back as he walked. He began wheezing terribly, as if he were asthmatic. As the man went through the doorway, Conrad said in an exaggerated whisper, "We'll kill you, motherfucker. We'll peel your fucking cap." The greaser said nothing. When Conrad returned to the bedroom, the old parties gave him incredulous looks, obviously wondering what sort of creature they had on their hands here. "I'm sorry," said Conrad. "That's the way you have to talk to these people. They're cheap thugs. It's the only language they'll take seriously."
"But where did you—"
Mrs. Gardner didn't quite know how to say it. "Where did I learn all that moronic lingo?" said Conrad. "From a movie. Some movie about a prison. I figured this guy was all talk anyway. He's a little old to be out working as a hoodlum."
"But as soon as you're gone," said Mr. Gardner, "he'll be back."
The "he'll be back" was a pitiful whine. "No, he won't," said Conrad. "He thinks I'm part of a gang."
"What gang?" said Mrs. Gardner.
"The Nordic Bund," said Conrad. "And believe me, if I thought the Nordic Bund was after me, I'd be frightened too."
"You mean it's actually over?"
said Mrs. Gardner. She put her face in her hands and looked up with a game smile. Then she recounted how the greaser had first approached them, saying he was a burglar alarm salesman. When they said they weren't interested, he returned, saying he was organizing a neighborhood security patrol. Foolishly, they made a contribution, and he began to come back more often. Soon it became obvious that it was pure extortion. He would descend on Louise Gardner when she left the house to go shopping. He would turn up in the house, coming in through the locked front door in ways they couldn't comprehend. They were terrified. He had been collecting $100 a week. Today he had said he was upping it to $150. She said they couldn't possibly, and that was when he took his cattle cane and destroyed 30 or 40 figurines.
"I couldn't believe the way you stood up to him," said Mrs. Gardner. "That took such courage."
She lowered her head and rubbed her eyes, and then looked up again. She was crying.
"How did you ever do what you just did?"
"It's hard to believe," said Conrad, "but most hoodlums are all talk. The last thing in the world they want is to go to the trouble of fighting. They specialize in victims who won't fight. As soon as they come up against somebody who might fight, they're ready to move off. Particularly a guy like that one who's already up in his 40s.
"But what do you do if you're confronted by a hoodlum who will fight?" said Mrs. Gardner. "What do you do then?"
"If you run into one of those—" "Then you better be ready to roll in the dirt," said Conrad. But in his mind he could hear 5-0 saying,
"Use the mouth, brother, use the mouth."
He felt radiant. He had used the mouth, and it had worked. That, and the spark of Zeus. Chapter 29. Epictetus in Buckhead. Brother and sister's house was so old-fashioned, it had only one bathroom, which was on the second floor. Conrad was at the mirror over the bathroom sink, half-finished shaving, when the telephone call came in. He could barely hear the ring, because the house also had only one telephone, which was in a tiny room downstairs, an office, more or less, practically buried beneath Hello Again's stupefying clutter. To get his attention, brother or sister had to stand in the hall and yell up. This time it was sister, who had a curious way of singing out his name with a higher note on the second syllable.
"Connie!"
He wiped the shaving cream off his face and hurried downstairs. He always knew who was calling, namely his employer, Carter Home Care. He wasn't about to give the number out to anyone else. The little office was, in fact, a windowless cubicle. The telephone was black, the first black telephone Conrad, a child of the 1970s, had ever seen. On the line, sure enough, was his employer, in the person of a middle-aged Chinese or Chinese-American woman named Lucy Eng. Conrad had only been to the Carter Home Care office once, the day he was hired, or, strictly speaking, put on their roster of nursing assistants, to be paid as used. The company, which was one of the biggest home care companies in Atlanta in terms of hours billed, seemed to consist entirely of Lucy Eng, her husband, Victor, two Chinese bookkeepers and three Chinese secretaries, all of them women, who also answered the telephone, which rang constantly, and five computers, in which was stored the roster of Carter Home Care's uniformed workers, from registered nurses and licensed physical therapists to strong backs, such as Conrad's. Victor Eng had chosen the name Carter because he thought it gave the company the aura of former President Jimmy Carter. American, Georgian, dignified, august, sympathetic, consoling, trustworthy, and old. The office was one flight up on Spring Street. Lucy Eng, in a very cheery voice,
"Connie, how are you?"
"I'm fine, Mrs. Eng." He had never heard her so happy to be talking to him.
"I don't know what you do for people, but they love you."
"Really?"
"Really. Mr. and Mrs. Gardner, they say you do very big things for them. Everybody likes your work, but Mrs. Gardner went on and on."
"They're very nice people, Mrs. Eng."
"Lucy."
"Lucy, thank you. I was glad to do whatever I could."
"They said you were brave, Connie, but they don't explain me."
"They're old, Mrs. Lucy, and things you could do for yourself in a minute, to them it seems very hard."
"Well, anyway, Connie, I have a very special assignment for you. Are you there?"
"Yes."
"We need a nursing assistant for a man who is coming home from the hospital today, a 60-year-old man, very prominent, very influential. Are you there?"
"Yes." "Who is he?"
"He's a very big real estate developer, very well known. He's just had surgery, knee replacement, and he's in a lot of pain. He lives in a big house in Buckhead. His name is Charles Croker."
The name Croker registered with Conrad immediately. But this man was a real estate developer, not somebody in the wholesale food business. So he thought nothing more of it.
"This a very important client for us," said Lucy Eng. "The saying goes, big men have big mouths. If he has a good experience, it will be very good for us."
"I understand," said Conrad. "I'll do my best." His new first name friend, Lucy, went on to describe exactly where the Croker House on Blackland Road was. He could take the MARTA line to Lenox Square, and then the number 40 bus west on West Paces Ferry Road, and another one north on Northside Drive.
"Could I walk from Lenox Square?" asked Conrad.
"You could, but it's a long way, and today is very hot, and I don't want you go to Croker's very sweaty. You promise me?"
"All right, I promise."
Charlie had become a morose, irritable, and, from the nurses, doctors, and therapists' point of view, stunningly ungrateful patient. At first, they attributed it to the CPM and the RRM. The RRM, for respiratory rate monitor, was strapped just beneath the chest. Whenever the patient's breathing became too slow, which was most likely to happen during sleep, the machine sounded an alarm. Thanks to the sedatives he was given, Charlie would begin to drop off to sleep. For the first time in months, and... Brang! The alarm would go off. Even so, few patients had complained so much about their care and shown so little gratitude to Mercy's archangels. The doctors, notably M.O. Knuckles, and angels, the nurses and physical therapists, as that ornery son of a bitch, Charlie Croker. So then they attributed it to a truism around hospitals, that is, that it's always the big authoritative leaders of men who make the most fearful, crotchety, and paranoid patients. None of them seemed to catch on to the fact that he was profoundly depressed. They told him that if he didn't exercise his knee more, in addition to what the CPM did, he ran the risk of clots forming, clots that could lodge in his lungs or his heart. Charlie said to himself, "Good, let's have some clots. Maybe I can stay in here, insulated from the Roger Whites and Planners Banks of Atlanta, a little longer." At this moment, Charlie, all 235 pounds of him, was slouched over, shell-backed, in a wheelchair, while two orderlies struggled to push it up a ramp into a van provided, for hire, by the Safeway Ambulance Service. Serena and the Wiz stood by with expressions that reminded Charlie of pallbearers. Despite all his hopes for clots, infection, fever, bleeding, incomplete flexion, and other pathological conditions, he was going home. In strict point of fact, there was no reason why he should be going home in a wheelchair or an ambulance. M.O. Knuckles hadn't wanted him to. The physical therapists didn't want him to. The nurses didn't want him to. And least of all, the orderlies who were pushing his bulk up the ramp. Everyone had urged him to use his knee, walk out of the hospital on an aluminum crutch, give his knee a workout, that being the shortest route to recovery after knee replacement surgery. That had let all the air out of Charlie's fondest wish, which was to be submerged beneath his moribund knee, to be laid out flat behind it, to drop out of life, until life improved. "Mr. Croker," said one of the nurses, a 23-year-old number named Stacy, who had accompanied him to the van, "please remember what I said. The only way to get well is to use that knee. Please do your exercises. If you don't, it's going to tighten up on you, and you'll never be able to loosen it up." Charlie wondered for a moment if a permanently tightened knee would be enough to keep him out of commission and let him drop out of sight, but realized pretty quickly that it wouldn't.
"Okay," he said to the nurse.
It came out as much like a groan as a word, and he didn't look at her. In a former life, not all that long ago, he would have looked at her a lot, but depressed men do not become aroused.
"Charlie," said Serena, "I'm going to drive our car home. I'll try to get there before you do, but Jermaine and Nina will be there in any case."
There was nothing wrong with what she said, but he didn't like the tone. It was the tone of frustration and suppressed rage with which you address a hopeless invalid who insists on making inroads into your free time.
Another cross between a mutter and a moan.
"Okay." By now the orderlies had pushed Charlie all the way onto the level floor of the van. He could hear the Wiz's voice outside. "So long, Serena. I should get back to the office. Tell Charlie to give me a ring if he thinks of anything."
"He has to say all that to Serena. It's as if I've been written off with Parkinson's or Huntington's chorea or Wegener's granulomatosis or whatever I heard them talking about in there."
An ambulance attendant rode in the back of the van with him and kept asking him, the way you ask a truly feeble old man, if everything was all right. At the house on Blackland Road, the yard had the lushness of summertime in Buckhead,
north of West Pace's Ferry. The trees, the maples, the oaks, the sycamores, the birch, and the pine provided a canopy up above that created a green and gold glow below. The magnolias and the boxwood had never looked fatter or shinier. Fabulous borders of ageratum, thrift, begonias, and anemones ran in waves of color along the edges of the grass that provided the green for the house's sumptuous green breast. All of that Charlie appreciated in the abstract, but he did not find it the least bit gratifying. Quite the opposite. His lawn, his trees, his grass, his shrubs and flowers had no business putting on such a show when he felt so depressed. The depressed man longs for heavy clouds, fog, mist, chilly weather, downpours, hail. With a good deal of panting and struggling, the Safeway ambulance service attendant and driver managed to get the wheelchair and its 235-pound load up the two low rises of steps that led to the front door and then up across the threshold. Jarmaine and Nina had opened the door and were waiting with enormous smiles. Totally insincere, thought Charlie. And many, "Mr. Croker's." Jarmaine said, "Bed ready in library, like you said." The ambulance men started to leave, but one of them, the driver, a reedy white man with bad posture, prematurely gray hair, and a mustache that was longer on one side than the other, came around in front of the wheelchair and said to Charlie, "I don't mean to put my 2 cents in." "But you will," thought Charlie. "Now, I'm no doctor." "But you're not about to let that stop you," thought Charlie. "But I don't think you should stay on the first floor, Mr. Croker. I used to do a lot of physical therapy, and I can tell you going up and down those stairs—" He gestured toward the grand half-spiral sweep of Charlie's main staircase. "Is one of the best things you can do for yourself. I've worked with a lot of patients." Charlie cut him off with, "Thank you." He was slumped forward in the wheelchair, and his head was bent forward, and he looked up at Mr. Almost a Doctor with as malevolent a look as he could muster. "I don't mean to be out of line," the man said, beginning to look flustered. "Thank you," said an utterly unsmiling Charlie. And the man with the mismatched mustache beat a retreat out the front door. The hell of it was, he knew the man was right. But what difference did it make? Recuperate? For what? Why do a lot of exercises and put yourself through a lot of pain, as if you're building toward some sort of future, when you know very well there is no future? The depressed man realizes that all daily routines imply a belief in tomorrow, and are cruel jokes, since, of course, tomorrow no longer exists. As Jarmaine pushed him toward the library, Charlie became suddenly aware of the fortune, not just in money, but also in time and care, that had gone into the first floor of this house. "God Almighty!" His eyes roamed. Jarmaine was saying something, and Nina was hovering, as only she could hover. But Charlie paid no attention to either of them. He felt enormously sorry for himself, an old man being trundled in a wheelchair to a bed in his library. A sorry old man letting his eyes wander helplessly over his worldly goods. Oh, Lord! The Amboyna Wood breakfront, the 18th-century grandfather's clock that didn't come from any grandfather of either of them, but cost more than either of his grandfathers had made in a lifetime of jukin' at the juke-houses and swamp-rattin' in the swamps in Baker County. How was it pronounced? Fatuies? The fabrics from whatever those thieves in New York were called. The lamps from that place in Nebraska, the cabinets, commodes Bombay, was that what Serena called them?
All of these names came flooding back into the brain of the poor old hulk as he was being wheeled across a stretch of carpet, which was another wildly expensive item introduced to North Georgia by Ronald Vine, the decorator. Serena had been experiencing for the first time the ecstasy of having an unlimited budget with which to buy things, objects, fabulous stuff. And what nonsense it all was! How vain and petty it all was! All this exulting over things! One day, soon enough, we'll all be gone, and there'll be people rooting through all this stuff like maggots. What are antiques, after all, but objects other maggots went over before you? And what is this whole house in the sacred Buckhead but a place he was renting until the next group of renters, as desperate to live in Buckhead as he was, took over? Merely renting. Of course, we think we've bought these things. We think we own them. What a marvelous piece of self-deception. If you add up the cost of maintaining a place like this, plus the interest lost through tying up $2 or $3 million in the so-called purchase, then there's your rent. You're only in here for a short time. You're only occupying the space until your mortal hide becomes hopelessly decrepit. Your children aren't going to keep the marvelous old place going. Don't kid yourself. They'll be off living with some dreadful creatures of their own generation in some hovel in Old Town in Chicago, or North Beach in San Francisco, or Tribeca in New York, or Coral Gables. They won't waste 2 tears thinking about the old manse with all its things, except to get their hands on the money that flows from all the new maggots rooting through the remains. He should apprise Wally of all this, tell him how life is actually put together. He should. But he had the terrible feeling that the breach between him and Wally was already too great. They had long since passed the point when he could have put his arm around Wally's shoulder and had a man-to-man talk. It was this damnable boarding school Martha had packed him off to, Trinium. They stuff these poor kids full of political correctness, and they end up pussies. His own son! Christ, at Turpentine the other weekend, Wally was as big a pussy as Herb Richman. He looks at me as if I'm some sort of barbarian. These children have no standards. They only know what they choose to be contemptuous of. "Mr. Croker, you go to bed now?" It was Jarmaine. She had pushed Charlie's wheelchair as far as the bed in the library. The bed really looked terrible in here. The library looked gloomy enough to start with, a thought that had never occurred to him before. What with all this dark carved wood? And now there's this musty old bed with a painted metal bedstead. Christ! Made him think of Jim Bowie on his deathbed, just before the Mexicans ventilated him with their bayonets. Not only that, there were a couple of things he had failed to figure out when he gave instructions about putting the bed down here on the first floor. The only toilet was the powder room, a staggeringly expensive little piece of nothing Ronald had fashioned out of marble, enamel, and brass. It was dazzling, and didn't have a shower or tub or even enough shelf space to line up all the vials of pills Ammo had burdened him with, much less anything else. Then there was no place to hang anything, such as a bathrobe or any other article of clothing he might want to wear. But what other article of clothing would he want to wear? No other. He was an invalid for the duration. He had a nurse's assistant, whatever that was, coming in to do all the physical chores he was too crippled to perform himself. The nurse's assistant could hang up the goddamned bathrobe. For the time being, he was going to sit in that big leather easy chair. He didn't feel like having Jarmaine or Nina watch him struggle out of his clothes and into pajamas. So they helped him out of the wheelchair, and he sank way back into the easy chair and stared at the library shelves with a hopeless, distracted gaze. The truth was, his knee scarcely hurt at this moment. But it would. It would. It was his screen against the world. Such were his sentiments when Serena arrived. He could hear her saying something to Jarmaine or Nina, although he couldn't tell what, and then he could hear the high heels of her shoes clack-clack-clacking across the marble floor of the entry hall. And now she appeared in the doorway of the library and stopped and put her hands on her hips. Charlie lowered his head like a guilty child who knows he's in for it.
"Charlie! For God's sake, what do you think you're doing? You haven't walked one step since you got home. I was just talking to Nina. She said you went straight from the wheelchair to that easy chair. You know what Emma told you. You know what the therapists told you."
What Charlie was thinking about had nothing to do with what she had just said. He could only think of how young she was. Because there was more light in the hall behind her than here in the library, she existed mainly as a silhouette of youth. The wild corona of hair, the long, straight, narrow neck, the wide shoulders, the tiny waist, the little silk dress that stopped a good 6 inches above her knees, in a fashion only a young woman with perfect legs would ever dare attempt. And hers were indeed perfect in every detail, even in the athletic way her thighs tapered down to where they inserted into the knees. The jaunty set of her hips, the curves the calves of her legs made, the tiny knobs of her ankles. He couldn't really see her breasts because the light was behind her, but he knew very well they were perfect, too. He knew it. But he didn't feel it, not for a moment. He knew very well that he was impotent, and had been for a while. He had made sure he had never had to put it to the test, but he knew it was so. An old, decrepit carcass was what he was. He was moldering, but he hadn't even had the decency to die yet. "I'm rotting flesh, and she is the very picture of youth. And she'll never nurse me. Oh, no."
"Charlie, are you with us? Are you listening to me?"
The flawless silhouette rearranged its arms akimbo upon the sprockets of its perfect hips.
"Yes," said Charlie. "I was just a little fatigued after that ride."
The penitent child drew his chin in even closer to his collarbone. He no longer thought about his own rule, namely that a leader never explains to his followers or to women. He was a child enjoying poor health.
"Fatigued," said the silhouette. "From what? You haven't moved a muscle all morning. Charlie, you've got to get going. You can't do this to yourself."
Charlie didn't say anything. He knew he could ride this storm out. Serena would get tired of the invalid, no matter what he did. In minutes, not days. She would persuade herself that it was utterly essential to go shopping, whether he flexed his miserable knee or didn't. The front doorbell rang, and Serena immediately wheeled about and marched into the entry hall to answer it.
"See? She doesn't wait for Jarmaine or Nina. She answers it herself. Any excuse to get away from the invalid."
He could hear her in conversation with someone, but he couldn't make out what she was saying, except for, "Come in." Conrad was stunned. She was the most gorgeous woman he had ever seen, and not much older than himself, if at all. She wore an apple-green dress with swirling floral patterns in it. A dress of such a light, filmy material, and so short, it seemed like nothing more than a mist hiding, but only halfway,
a lissom young body. Her mouth had an oddly playful smile.
Playful about what?
He became terribly self-conscious.
What an insignificant mortal he was, standing before this house and this beautiful woman in his Carter Home Care get-up, his white polo shirt with the green Carter logo on the breast pocket, his white duck pants with the green piping down the side of each leg, the fake leather white shoes.
"Hello, I'm Con—" He hesitated. He had come close to saying, "Conrad."
"I'm Connie DeCasse. I'm from Carter Home Care."
"Oh, yes," she said. "Come in."
She opened the screen door, and he had taken two or three steps inside when she added, "I'm Serena Croker." Conrad assumed she was the old man's daughter or daughter-in-law. He looked back to acknowledge her introduction, then looked away immediately, for fear of seeming to want to stare at her, which he did. The entry hall where he stood was enormous. The beautiful young woman indicated that he should follow her. She led him to a doorway off the entry gallery and, just before entering, said,
"My husband will be staying in here temporarily."
My husband? Should he take that to mean that this gorgeous young woman was the wife of the 60-year-old man named Croker?